From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Homicide, Life on the Street. Tom Fontana is the writer-producer behind the TV series Oz, St. Elsewhere, and Homicide, the first two seasons of which are just coming out on DVD. Also, Emotions Revealed. We speak with Paul Ekman. He's a facial expressions expert who's consulted for the FBI. He can tell the difference between a real and a fake smile, and he'll explain how the face can betray a lie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council has overwhelmingly approved a resolution lifting sanctions on Iraq. The vote came after the U.S. and Britain agreed to some changes that strengthened the UN's role in Iraqi reconstruction. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said the agreement would help heal some of the divisions in the UN before the Iraq War.
Whatever differences there have been in the recent past, we now have a new basis on which to work.
The lifting of sanctions is expected to start the flow of Iraqi oil into world markets. The money will go into a new Iraq Development Fund to be administered by the U.S. and Britain and monitored by the U.N. The Pentagon has appointed a chief prosecutor and defense counsel for any military trials related to the war on terror. So far, the president hasn't decided to place anyone before these special courts. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Army Colonel Fred Bork will serve as acting chief prosecutor. Air Force Colonel William Gunn will be acting chief defense counsel. They will each head a team of military attorneys. They indicated they are looking at a number of possible cases, but they await a determination by President Bush that a defendant should be tried in a military court. The Pentagon says that any commission would be fair and provide familiar rights, such as the presumption of innocence and the right to refuse to testify. But some legal experts say the rules for the commissions favor the prosecution. The administration has indicated it might move certain terror cases to military commissions, including that of Zacharias Moussaoui, who is awaiting trial in a Virginia federal court. Hundreds of detainees from Afghanistan could also face military commission trials at some point. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
The National 9/11 Commission opened a hearing today on Capitol Hill to examine intelligence failures before the terrorist attacks. Some lawmakers criticized the Bush administration for refusing to declassify a report on intelligence failures made last year. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Commissioners heard testimony from lawmakers in charge of intelligence oversight on Capitol Hill. Alabama Senator Richard Shelby urged commissioners to recommend new centralized leadership for the intelligence community, which is currently spread across 15 agencies. He argues the intelligence director should become a cabinet-level position. Arizona Senator John McCain criticized the Bush administration's response to questions about the 9/11 attacks. He said excessive administration secrecy feeds conspiracy theories and reduces the public's confidence in government. The bipartisan commission created by Congress will ultimately create a set of recommendations designed to guard against terrorist attacks. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices rose today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 77 points to close at 8,594, and the NASDAQ gained 17 to close at 1507. This is NPR News. The FBI is investigating yesterday's explosion in a classroom at Yale University Law School. Witnesses say the agents are asking students if they can identify a sketch of a young man with a round face and glasses. The blast damaged two rooms in the building and set off a sprinkler system that caused water damage to several hundred rare law books. There were no injuries. The building's closed, but officials say they hope to reopen it in time for the law school commencement on Monday. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have come up with several possible explanations for why SARS has spread so rapidly in Taiwan. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
SARS in Taiwan started out with just a few cases in March and early April, but then the disease really took off. To date, nearly 500 people have been hospitalized with SARS in Taiwan. 17% have been discharged, and 12% have died. The CDC suggests several possibilities for the rapid spread. In Taiwan, families often hire personal attendants for their relatives, and these personal attendants are generally not issued masks, gowns, and gloves, or trained in how to use them. Symptoms of the disease were often ascribed to other chronic conditions like kidney disease. And as was reported in Singapore, cases of SARS initially went unrecognized in people with damaged immune systems who didn't develop the hallmark fever. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
Rates for home mortgage rates have hit a record low. The mortgage company Freddie Mac reports that the rate for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is now down to 5.34%. That's the lowest it's been since the company started tracking rates in the early 1970s. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 8 points to close at 931. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. For 20 years now, writer-producer Tom Fontana has made some of the best television series on television. He got his start on St. Elsewhere, working under the late Bruce Paltrow. He worked with Barry Levinson on Homicide: Life on the Street, then went from NBC to HBO to create Oz, a series about life in prison that ended earlier this year. Oz was the first Fontana series to be released on DVD. Next week, Homicide, 10 years after its debut, also gets the home video treatment, with a four-disc set from A&E Home Video covering the show's first two seasons. Homicide's very talented cast includes Andre Brower, Ned Beatty, Richard Belzer, Kyle Secor, and Yaphet Kotto. They play Baltimore detectives whose successes and failures are written up in plain view on the precinct's big board. Solved cases in black ink, unsolved cases in red. The unsolved cases, for these persistent characters, are hard to let go of. Even very old cases. Here's Clark Johnson as Meldrick, talking to his partner Crosetti, played by John Polito. They're sitting in a hospital room, killing time while waiting for a patient, who's also a suspect, to wake up.
You look pitiful, man. You all right?
I couldn't sleep last night. My mind was racing all night long. Even when I was sleeping, I was dreaming about it.
What?
There were two people in the box with Lincoln the night he was shot. There was John Wilkes Booth, and there was a Major Henry Rathbone. Now, how come we don't hear about this Henry Rathbone?
So you think Major Henry Rathbone's the guy that capped Lincoln, huh?
I don't know. It just doesn't hang together.
Hey, man, Booth jumped down on the stage, broke his leg trying to get away.
The president was shot. What the hell would you do?
This is what kept you up on it.
Who was the doctor who set John Wilkes Booth's leg? It was Dr. Samuel Mudd, okay? 100 years later, who gets passed over for Anchorman? Roger Mudd. It's his great-great-grandson. What does that tell you about the power structure in this country?
Excuse me. I didn't notice. Was Abraham Lincoln on the board this morning?
Meldrick. All our lives since we're kids, we were taught in the history book that John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln. Now, if that's not true, maybe nothing's true.
Tom Fontana, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Good to be back.
What's fun for you about Homicide in particular in terms of the DVD? I know that even the packaging, you know, trumpets the fact that see them in the actual order in which the producers intended for the first time.
Yes,
which has got to be a dig at NBC.
Yeah, totally. When I saw that, I loved that because we were always fighting with NBC because we would, you know, we would plot these episodes very carefully, A leading to B, leading to C, leading to D. And they would see an episode and they go, oh, we're going to put this one in sweeps. And you go, well, if you put that one in sweeps. I mean, the classic example is the death of
Crosetti,
because he had been dead 2 weeks before the episode where he died aired. So people were like, what are they talking about? Crosetti's dead? Like, if I miss something? It was just, it was incredibly frustrating for us. You know, and it's not like what was great about Homicide was it wasn't like if they showed one over the other, suddenly our numbers would spike. You know what I mean? The people who were going to watch the show were the people who were going to watch the show. It wasn't like suddenly they're going to go, oh, you know, some guy who would rather be watching Nash Bridges is not suddenly going to go, hey, whoa, I saw that one where the guy dies. We got to go and we got to watch that show this week, you know? So I never understood the network's penchant for flipping our episodes around.
Now,
and you'd think we would have learned over the course of the seasons to stop doing it the way we were doing it so we wouldn't get screwed, but we didn't.
I'd like to ask you some questions after 20 years of doing television, after St. Elsewhere, after Oz, after Homicide, what you've learned that you're passing on to younger writers or what you think of just the state of television right now. I mean, what do you think of reality shows? What do you think of cable versus network? That sort of stuff.
Well, the first thing, I think it's potentially the most exciting time to be a young writer, a young director, a young actor in television, maybe even a young producer, because there are so many outlets to try things where, you know, back in the day, there were three networks. And if you couldn't get on one of those three networks, you were out of the game. Now there's so many places to go and try things and cable and all the variations and all the kind of specific kind of channels that exist. So I think it's a very exciting time. The reality television thing I'm not so afraid of because I think, oh, it's going to burn itself out. I think it will. But because I keep coming down to the side that you don't cry at the end of a reality television show. You will cry at the end of an episode of NYPD Blue. We do something. People who write dramas and comedies do something different and serve a different need than reality television shows. So I'm a big believer in the survival of drama. I don't think we're going anywhere. And I think, you know, shows like Boomtown, Kingpin, you know, The Wire, all those shows that came up last year are just another example of how strong the next generation of television writers are.
In the first batch of Homicide episodes, it led up to an episode that you wrote called Three Men and a Dina, which I still think is one of the best things I've ever seen television. And it is basically Kyle Secor and Andre Brower and guest star Moses Gunn, who is the suspect in a murder of a young girl, in an interrogation room for an hour. And the rhythms of these actors is so amazing through this hour. And I'd like to play a piece of it. It comes about halfway through. They have to interrogate this guy and get a confession out of him within 12 hours, or they have to cut him loose. And this is well into the night, and it is a sequence in which they are just speeding up their pace of everything, trying to shake this guy.
You want to know what the polygraph test says? You're lying. You're a liar. You even tried to hold your breath to cover up. But you know what blew it off the charts? Off the screen? Look here. Your heart. Your heart just blew those needles right off the screen, man. A man could get whiplash looking at your test. And this guy says it's the highest he's ever seen, and this guy is an expert.
Your heart of all things, that's perfect for you, Risley. Don't you see? Your heart, because your heart doesn't want to lie.
Let me see that.
No. This is police property. This is evidence for your trial.
I know enough about the law to know you can't use that in court.
Listen to Mr. Legal Beagle here. He knows all about the law.
Is that because you watched the court channel?
I didn't lie.
Well, then how come you failed the test?
I don't know.
That's your answer for everything.
Well, it's not going to work now.
If you weren't lying, why'd you fail your test?
I was nervous.
Why were you nervous?
Feel guilty.
You feel guilty because you did it.
No, because you made me feel guilty.
No, you failed this test because you are guilty.
If I was guilty and knew it, then why would I take the test?
You tell us.
No, I know why. I'll tell you why.
Because you know we got you. You know it's over, Risley.
You're going to jail.
You're gonna do time.
That's right.
Tim, look at his eyes.
What's wrong with my eyes?
Tears coming out of your eyes.
There ain't no tears coming from my eyes.
His eyes are brimming with tears.
Ready to burst.
It's gonna get a lot worse.
A lot worse.
It never gets any better.
You'll probably go back.
Back to being a drunk. No, I ain't never gonna do that.
And you wind up killing yourself.
If you're lucky.
I didn't kill her. Why you putting your head down?
Because I'm tired of saying it.
You're tired of saying it because it's not true.
Be a man for once. Own up to it.
I would. Anybody else would too.
Be a man for once.
Why don't you want to tell me, Risley?
Huh?
Why don't you want to tell me?
Huh?
Why?
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 Huh? All right, don't say it.
Don't say it, Risley.
All right?
Don't say it.
All right, that was a scene from Three Men and a Dina from Homicide. With Kyle Secor, Andre Brower, and Moses Gunn. How much of that was on set with the actors and the director, and how much of that was on the page in terms of the speed?
Well, the from a dialogue point of view, everything was in the script from a rhythm point of view, that was something that was developed by the actors and the director, Martin Campbell, in a very, very, very short amount of rehearsal time. Though the thing you have to remember is that I only had the courage to write that episode based on the fact that I had seen what these two guys could do, the two actors could do, in the pilot episode, in the very first episode. So because I'm a kind of writer that once I get an actor's voice in my head, mm-hmm. It's much easier to write for them. And I have to say, Martin Campbell, when he was directing it, he spent about 3 days before we started shooting that episode in the box, living in that room and looking at it from every single angle. And what he did as a director, which is extraordinary, is he never shot after a certain sequence of, like, say, let's say 5 or 10 pages. He never shot from that angle again. So the entire hour keeps changing the point of view of the camera so that you never get tired of being in that room. So it was really that episode, obviously I'm very proud of, because the people who worked on it really gave it everything they had and were incredibly inventive with something that could have been a pretty dull hour of television if they hadn't cared so much.
Tom Fontana, creator of Oz and writer-producer of St. Elsewhere and Homicide: Life on the Street. The first two seasons of Homicide will be released next week on DVD. Back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking to Tom Fontana about the release of Homicide: Life on the Street and other things that he's done on DVD. I don't know if you've thought this far ahead with DVD problems, but what happens when you get to a Homicide season where a story began on Homicide and ended on Law and Order?
Well, actually, it went the opposite way. All the crossover shows that we did all started on Wednesdays and ended on Fridays because I kept saying to Dick, well, I need the big number. You already get the big number, so you have to give me the concluding episode.
Uh-huh.
But having said that, what we did very carefully was to make – he made his episode self-contained and we made our episode self-contained so that you could enjoy our episode if you didn't see the Law and Order and vice versa. So I don't think anybody seeing those episodes on DVD are going to suddenly go, what was that about? Because we really laid down the information for the audience.
You know, I must say those crossovers always struck me as so strange. They were entertaining, but it's like Dick Wolf's whole idea with Law & Order is you don't want to know these guys outside of work. And on Homicide is like you don't even really want to know the work. That's all you want to know is the guys outside.
That's true.
So
it's funny. Jerry Orbach, God love Jerry, he comes to Baltimore, and we had that scene in the first crossover where he and Belzer are talking in the bar, and they're talking about how Belzer realizes that Orbach's character has slept with his ex-wife. And at this scene when the director called cut, Orbach comes over and he goes, wow, I actually had sex. My character had sex. He was like, you know, the most exciting thing I get to say on Law and Order is, what color was the car, ma'am? You know, he said, now I'm actually talking about my sex life. And we had him playing pool, which, of course, knowing Jerry a long time, I knew he was a brilliant pool player, so that we didn't even have to do the fake, you know, okay, now let's cut away to the cue, you know,
right.
and you know, get the expert in to make the actual shot. Jerry knows all that stuff, so he's a fabulous pool player, and it was so much fun having them come down, Ben Brad and all of them. And I don't know if you know this story, but Jill Hennessy It was worse for the Law and Order people than it was for us, because we had so many characters, we could write somebody low in an episode and send them up to New York to be on Law and Order.
Mm-hmm.
With them, because they basically have, you know, three people in one section, three people in the other section, it was harder for them to send them down to Baltimore for us. And Jill Hennessy was needed. We needed her down in Baltimore to shoot a substantial scene. They needed her in New York to sit in the courtroom while Sam Waterston made one of his summations. So we were all like, well, what are we going to do? And, you know, the thing, and they really needed her there because the character had been involved in the story, and it would have seemed weird if she suddenly wasn't there. And it turns out Jill has a twin. So,
oh, no kidding.
I swear to God. So the only time in the history of Law and Order, Jill Hennessy's sister played her character. She had no dialogue. She just sat in the chair. And meantime, Jill was down in Baltimore working with us. So,
okay. I have to admit, I still think about some of your characters. And I always wanted Bayless from Homicide to be, like, thrown into prison in Oz just to keep that going, even though I know it couldn't work. Do you ever not let go of your characters or think about them from time to time and think about where you might have taken them next or where they might be?
Well, I will say this, that I think about them for many, many years after I stop writing the show. But then that it becomes almost like a death, in the sense of that you then put that character in a place where you think of it fondly, but it's not haunting you the way it once did. But to this day, I'll be, you know, reading the paper, and I'll see something about medicine, and I'll go, wow, this will make a great episode of St. Elsewhere. And then I have to go, oh, no, wait, we don't do that anymore. You know, and being somebody who doesn't want to repeat myself and doesn't want to do, you know, Homicide, The Next Generation, or Son of Oz, or any of that stuff, it's harder, because I those muscles get so primed, and then I'm consciously letting those muscles get soft to try to build up other writing muscles. So it's a little bit frustrating, but you know, when a great actor really fills a character out, they don't go away that easy.
When you got pulled into television, you were writing for the stage. And I assume at that time, or I presume, that you wanted to have a career as a playwright.
Yes.
Do you still? Do you think about going back and writing something for the stage now?
Well, it seems that over the course of time, first of all, I was not a very good playwright. And I was not a very successfully produced playwright. But over the course of time, the theater has discovered that I write something much better than a play, and that's a check. So the theater seems to be very happy that I'm not writing plays and that I am writing checks. Having said that, what's interesting, too, for me about where my head has gone as a writer is I thought of myself as a playwright, and over the last 20 years, I've started to think of myself as just a writer, in this, not just a writer, but you know what I mean, as a writer in the broader sense of the term. I would like to write another play. I don't know. I don't want to clutter the theater up with another bad play. So unless I come up with a really good and compelling play to write, I don't think I will. But I would like to, if I could. I'd like to write a book. I'd like to write an epic poem. I'd like, you know, I would like to keep challenging myself as a writer, not just in the television stuff that I do, but in the but in all the writing that I do.
I have a couple questions about your method of writing. I know that you write in the morning, just about every morning. Do you play music when you write?
No. Actually, I get up at 5:30 every single morning, and I write. It's usually dark, and I like to say that that's when New York takes its little breath. One of the few times that New York takes a breath at 5:30 in the morning. And in that breath is when I try to really kind of focus in on the work. So it becomes, it's very solitary. There's no distractions. I don't, I go from my bed to my desk and I start writing. I have very, very little ritual connected to it other than the stumbling in the dark to try to find the light. There's not much... There's not much, because I think the more awake you are at the beginning, the harder it is to start.
Mm-hmm.
It, to me, it has to be seamless, coming out of sleep and going right into the unconsciousness of writing.
Do you dream about what you're going to be writing the next day or plan to write the next day?
I do. I'll give you the short version of my quote-unquote process, which is that before I go to bed, I review the first thing I'm going to write in the morning, the first scene and what the point is and what the purpose of and who the characters are. And I don't do a lot of time. I just think about it for a little bit. And then I go to sleep. And as I'm coming out of sleep, I am actually the last dream I have of the morning, in the morning, is the scene that I'm going to be writing, that first scene that I'm going to be writing. Now, it doesn't happen 100% of the time, but it happens the majority of the time. And what it does is it just it makes going from sleep to writing almost seamless, if you will, because my mind is already – there are times when I literally have to – when I sit up in bed because I have to get out of bed to write because of what I've just had in my head in the dream.
Did you ever have a dream and you woke up and you thought, this is going to be the best hour of television ever, and by the time you wake up or have a cup of coffee and start actually putting it down, you realize it's like one of those awful, dumb dreams that don't make any sense at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, I used to keep a pad by my bed and thinking that, oh, this will be great. I'll write down in the middle of the night, I get an idea. And one night I got up, I woke up and I had this dream where I had everything worked out, and it was amazing. And I wrote down, scribbled down, went back to sleep, got up the next morning excited, and all it said was boy meets girl. So I thought I had gotten every nuance, every scene down. I mean, I thought I'd been writing for like an hour. I wrote three words.
Well, I wouldn't throw away your dream, because I think in those three big series of yours, I don't think you've done boy meets girl yet. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Oh, thank you.
Tom Fontana, whose Homicide: Life on the Street is about to be released on DVD. Fontana is also creator of Oz and a writer-producer on Sane Elsewhere. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
It's really getting to me. I wake up in the morning, I'm lying in bed, and I'm checking around my own body to see if there's a chalk outline.
Yeah, you should see what we went through at the cemetery today.
You know, I could retire with half pension and go into the drywall business with my brother.
Now, come on, you retire, that's like saying you're going to be a ballerina. It ain't possible.
Last year, we had 325 cases, we solved three quarters. This year, we'll have 350, solve another three quarters. It's like mowing the lawn. You mow the lawn, the next week, you got to mow it again.
It's homicide. One thing this country's still good at.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, when you're smiling, are you faking it, or did you really think your boss's joke was funny? Paul Ekman has spent his life studying facial expressions. He'll tell us what our faces reveal and how to read people when they're not telling the truth. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Paul Ekman is a psychologist who specializes in reading, but not in reading books or journals or case studies. He reads people's faces and has devoted his life to understanding and analyzing why people react in certain ways when they're not telling the truth. Oliver Sacks calls Ekman the most astute analyst of emotions since Darwin. And in these days of high security checkpoints and concerns about terrorism, Ekman's theories and observations are in strong demand. He's worked as consultant on emotional expression for the FBI and the CIA, and for Pixar and Industrial Light and Magic, where he's advised animators on how to create more lifelike expressions for their characters. Ekman is author of an earlier book, Telling Lies. His new book is called Emotions Revealed: Recognizing Faces and Feelings to Improve Communication and Emotional Life. Terry spoke with Ekman earlier this week.
What types of facial expressions do you think are shared among all humans? We're all wired to use this facial expression to express certain emotions.
There are seven that they're really very good evidence for. Fear, anger, sadness, and anguish, which is sort of the other side of sadness. Disgust. Contempt, which is a word that we have a hard time hearing in English. It sounds like content, but I mean the feeling of being morally superior to another person. Surprise. And then there is a particular signal for enjoyment, for actual real enjoyment, rather than the social smiles and all of that. So I think I've given you seven. And they appear to be the same no matter what your age, culture, race, or sex is. Anywhere in the world.
Why do you care if facial expressions are universal or if they're unique to cultures?
Well, they're practical and theoretical reasons. Practical reason is you need to know whether you need a Berlitz book when you go traveling abroad to read the expressions of other people. I mean, it was Charles Darwin who really made this discovery. I just got some of the more solid evidence for it. But when Darwin went on his voyage of the Beagle, and he traveled for 5 years all over the world to really obscure places, he couldn't understand the languages of the people, but he could understand their emotions. And so a little light bulb clicked that sort of fit with his developing theory of evolution and the continuity of the species. So if they're universal practically, that means this is something that we can understand in other people without needing a translation. Theoretically, it means that this must be the product of our evolution, and there must be a strong biological component to the phenomena of emotion. It also means that there may well be a link to other animals, as Darwin claimed, and we might even want to entertain the notion that other animals have emotions, not just humans, and maybe that would have an impact on how we treat other animals. So there's lots of different reasons.
In order to confirm that facial expressions were universal and not just inherent to specific cultures, you had to go to isolated cultures, cultures that hadn't been exposed to mass media, cultures in which there weren't tourists coming in from other countries, just to see what are the facial expressions of these isolated people. So what cultures did you choose to study that?
I found a culture in the New Guinea Highlands called the South Foray, that was being studied by a pediatric neurologist named Carlton Gajdacek. And he was there because 50% of these people were dying of an unknown disease, and he was trying to track it. And fortunately enough, Gajdacek had taken movie film, over 100,000 feet of film, of these people who had never seen an outsider, and he was willing to lend it to me before I went. And when I watched these films, I mean, it took almost a year to watch them, I was then convinced. Up until then, I was not certain whether Darwin was right or Margaret Mead was right, really the two opposing positions about facial expressions. But if Mead was right, then I should have seen expressions I'd never seen before, which was not the case, or they should have occurred in very different social contexts, which was not the case. So then I set out to go there and do experiments in this Stone Age culture that could actually document the fact that these were universal to our species, and I knew there wasn't much time left. And in point of fact, within 2 years, Western culture had invaded these isolated villages that I worked in.
Give us an example of one of the experiments that you came up with.
Well, one of the virtues, these people, of course, didn't know what a camera was. They'd never seen a photograph. They'd never seen their own face. They'd never seen a mirror. There was no still water that they could look at themselves. So I would set up my camera, and I would go from English to pidgin, and I'd say, tell me what your face would look like if you learned that your child had died. Another one, friends have come up that you like and you haven't seen for a while, or you're angry about to fight. And each time, I mean, if I showed you these pictures, they're in my book if you saw them, you have no problem understanding them. If you heard their language, you wouldn't know what in the world they're saying. Or if you saw their gestures, you wouldn't know what they're talking about. But the facial expressions of emotion are universal.
Now, we can all recognize what anger looks like, but you've actually mapped out the muscles of the face that are used when somebody is displaying anger on their face. What does anger look like from your point of view, having actually codified it?
Well, you know, I developed something that's sort of the equivalent of musical notation for the face. And so it allows us to describe in quantitative terms, because I don't want to use the Latin names, they're too cumbersome. So the prototypic anger expression involves the lowering of the eyebrows and pulling them together, and that's action unit 4. The raising of the upper eyelid, that's action unit 5. The lowering, the tightening of the lower eyelid, that's action unit 7. So we now have a 4-5-7. That's quite sufficient for a very loud anger signal. But you can add to it the narrowing of the red margins of the lip, that's number 23. And then you can either, if you're speaking, your lips will become square, and that's number 22. Or if you're trying to control yourself from speaking, or if you're about to hit somebody, you'll do the same thing. You'll press your lips together firmly, and that's number 24. So in my terminology, it's a 4-5-7-23, let's say 24.
Now, you said it's the lowering of the lower lids and the raising of the upper brows or something?
I went too fast. It's a, in terms of the eyes,
yeah,
the upper eyelid is raised and the lower eyelid is tense simultaneously. That causes the eyes to glare. And if you pull down the brow at the same time, Terry, then you have a very
I'm telling
strong,
you, I can't do it. It's too hard.
Well, not everybody can do it voluntarily. If you were able to do it, and if I coached you and could show it to you, actually, this is one I'm quite confident that with 2 minutes of coaching, because I've done research this way, you'd be able to do this one. And when you did, your heart rate would start to increase, your blood pressure would go, your blood would go to your hands would get hot, you'd be prepared to hit somebody, your blood pressure would increase, you would begin to sweat slightly. All the physiological changes that have been adaptive in our ancestral past when we're angry. That doesn't mean that you have to hit anybody. You might make a joke, depends on what you've learned about how to deal with anger. But evolution's preparing you for what's been most useful in the history of our species.
The other thing is that you're suggesting if you make a certain expression that signifies an emotion, you will respond as if you were having that emotion, even though you're just faking the expression.
That's right. Stanislavski said, make the movement and the feeling will follow. And this is, there are many different ways to access an emotion or trigger an emotion. This is one of the most unexpected ones, that by simply making the muscular movements of one of the universal expressions, if you're able to do all of the movements that are required, then without choice, many of the physiological changes in your brain and in your body that are unique to that emotion will begin to occur.
Paul Ekman, talking with Terry Gross. His book is called Emotions Revealed. We'll hear more of their conversation in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Paul Ekman, author of Emotions Revealed.
Let's look at the smile. You've learned to distinguish between the faked or half-hearted smile and the real smile, and it's not based on how far your lips are spread. It's based on the eyes. What have you noticed?
Well, actually, it's not my discovery. I'm just the one who did the research to show that it's correct, and I've extended it a bit. And so I called the true smile of enjoyment the Duchenne smile in honor of Duchenne, Dr. Duchenne, a neurologist who published in 1862, and although Darwin paid attention to him, almost every scientist up until me ignored it as if the work was never done. And what Duchenne said was that it is the muscle that orbits the eye that does not obey the will, and its absence, I'm giving you the English translation, unmasks the false friend. And he was able to show that by photographing the same person when he told him a joke and when he just simply stimulated the muscle that pulls the lip corners. And it's only in the joke that you, if you like the joke, that you get the muscle that orbits the eyes. But it's a very subtle sign. It's not easy to spot. And where you have to look is in what's technically called the eye cover fold, the skin in between the eyebrows and the upper eyelid, and the inner parts of the eyebrow. And in true enjoyment, they'll move down very slightly.
Now, we all know that, to some extent, we could read people from the expression in their eyes, but you've codified that too.
This is a very subtle sign, which means it hasn't evolved to the point of being easy to recognize. You need to be taught it, and then you have to work hard to see it, which means that probably for most of the time human beings have been on this planet, it was enough to just know that that enjoyment was being shown, and there was no particular advantage to know whether it was true enjoyment or not.
Do you think that lying registers on somebody's face?
Well, I define lies in a way that not everyone does, that a lie is a deliberate attempt to mislead another person without any notification. So you can deceive people in poker, but you can't really lie because everybody knows when you play poker, you're going to bluff. Now, the only lies that you can really read from the face itself, I mean, in my work on deception, we deal with the body and the voice and the speech as well. But the face will tell us about concealed emotions. So if I said to you, Terry, I'm just having a great time talking to you, but actually I'm really quite worried about how I'm getting across, but I don't want you to see that fear, there might be a micro expression of fear. And that's a concealed emotion. If you like, that's I am lying about how I feel. When Marcia Clark, the prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson case, was badgering Cato Kalin about whether he had a book contract, which he did, but he was denying, he was lying. There's a beautiful micro-expression. It's just two video fields, 15th of a second, of an enormous snarl. Now, when you show that videotape to people who haven't been trained to spot these, they think he's just feeling fine. They don't see it. But we have the apparatus with to be able to see these micro-expressions. So it's only concealment of emotion that the face can tell us about, not concealment of plans, values, thoughts, opinions.
You have consulted to the CIA and to the FBI. You've done some work on terrorism. We're in a situation now as a country where we're trying to find terrorists before they commit their next action. What kind of suggestions have you made about how terrorists can be spotted?
Well, this is a hard topic to talk about for a couple of reasons. First, most of the teaching I've done up until 9/11 has been to law enforcement, which is a much easier situation. And most of what I teach law enforcement is how to spot the signs when you're not getting a full account, and in particular, how to identify the truthful person who's under suspicion. Because spotting, in a law enforcement situation, spotting the liar is not very hard. The problem is that there are truthful people who, because they're under suspicion, look like they're lying. and can get misjudged and can end up in prison because of that misjudgment, not just by the police, but then by the jury.
What are some of the things that you can look
for?
Well,
let me give you a very concrete example. Your spouse has been murdered. You're going to be the first person interrogated, unless you're out of the country, because just on an actuarial basis, unfortunately, a high percentage of murders are committed by the spouse. But let's suppose you're truly innocent. You didn't do it, and my God, you're in a state of mourning, and you want your spouse's murderer to be found, and here they are, wasting their time and casting aspersions on you, interrogating you, so you're getting very angry. You're also getting a bit afraid. God, are they going to misjudge me? Now, it's likely, at least there are many cases, where you're going to conceal those emotions because you think if you just start attacking these guys, you're going to make things even worse. Now, the untrained law enforcement person would see, he would get some kind of intuitive hunch, something's wrong. He wouldn't know what's being concealed is anger or fear because he hasn't been trained to be able to spot that specifically or to be alerted to the fact that innocent people often are angry and afraid about being interrogated. So he might, the untrained policeman might mistakenly think, aha, this guy isn't giving me the truth about the crime. It's not about the crime he isn't giving you the truth. He's not giving you the truth about how you feel. If they went through the training specifically on facial expression, they'd be able to see this person's angry and afraid, and they might well then say, listen, am I getting under your skin? Are you getting really angry that I'm asking you these questions? They'd be able to clear this up.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Ekman. He's a professor of psychology at the University of California Medical School in San Francisco, and he's the author of the new book, Emotions Revealed, which is based on his extensive research into facial expressions. Do you see something in your face when you look in the mirror that you never saw until you started this research?
No. I don't see anything new in my face. I mean, of course, what I see that's new in my face are wrinkles as I get older, but I don't really see more than I ever saw before. And, of course, I don't get to see my face when it's lively. Other people see it. We don't know what's on our face. The feedback for touch or pain or heat is exquisite on our face. But the feedback that is to be aware of what expression's beginning to emerge or is actually on your face, it's very badly represented in conscious awareness. That's why people often say to you, what's upsetting you? Why are you looking so downcast? And that's the first time you realized you were downcast and you sure didn't know it was on your face. Others see us. We don't see ourselves.
Do you ever get accused of invading people's privacy because you can, or at least they're afraid that you can, know what they're really thinking by reading these micro expressions?
Well, it certainly is a danger that I'm very aware of. And I've written very explicitly about if once you are able to get information that people aren't really wanting to give to you, they're not volunteering it, you're picking up these very subtle or very brief expressions. In a sense, you're stealing information. Now, what do you do with that to be constructive rather than destructive? And I've discussed that and how you use that in a business setting, how you use that in a family life, and how you use that with friendship. And my main point is you have to really consider, what am I entitled to? If I say to my daughter, how was your day today? And I see a look of sadness on her face, that's very different from as to what I'm going to do, given my relationship with my daughter, which is a very frank one, than from what I would do if I saw that same expression on someone who was just an acquaintance or who was an employee. So I think we need to be very judicious, once we learn how to do this, as to how we use it in a constructive. I think it can be used in a destructive fashion. It's a two-edged sword. By and large, though, my working assumption, which might be wrong, is that we and the world are better off if we understand the emotions we're each feeling at the moment we're feeling them.
Paul Ekman talking with Terry Gross. His book is called Emotions Revealed. We'll hear more of their conversation in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Paul Ekman, author of Emotions Revealed.
Do you think that good politicians, press spokespeople, news anchors, people who are in public positions delivering information, do you think that some of them are particularly kind of gifted at knowing how to use facial expressions or intuitively using them?
Yes, I call those people, I used to call them natural liars, but I changed it because it's too pejorative. And I call them natural performers.
Uh-huh.
And most of them are people who can become the role they're playing as they play it. And if you believe what you're saying, then of course you're not lying, and you can be very effective. And, I mean, any actor does that. But any good public performer has to be able to do that. So these days, I mean, when... I don't think this was, of course, so 100 years ago, but these days you're not going to get into any of the positions that you mentioned unless you are such a performer.
Well, while we're on the subject of politicians, you have as one of your illustrations in your book, you have a photograph of President Reagan embracing one of the leaders of the NAACP, and this is a woman who had just given a speech very critical of President Reagan, mm-hmm. and he's smiling and embracing her. And you say about the smile that it's a real grin and bear it kind of smile. What are you seeing on Reagan's face that led you to that conclusion?
Yes, it's one of my favorite smiles. It's the smile that any of us give to the dentist when he says that you have to have a root canal and it's going to cost a lot of money and it's going to hurt. And you give them this grin and bear it or miserable smile. And nobody thinks that you're enjoying it, but it's saying, I'm going to go along with this. And this is sort of, in this situation, it's a good sport smile. So he's got a very broad smile, but the crucial thing is that he's pressing his lips together tightly and pushing up his lower lips. This is a smile that former President Clinton used again and again. It almost was a mannerism for President Clinton. He would add one more thing. He'd pull his lip corners down. So that when President Clinton first appeared in the primaries, I guess that was 92 with all the other candidates, I was watching keenly, and he was giving a particular, this a variation on this that I thought was the expression of, I've got my hand in the cookie jar and you've caught me. And I said to my wife, this is Peck's bad boy. This is a guy who wants to get caught and have us love him as a rascal. And she said, come on, she said, you don't know what you're talking about. And of course, it did turn out that I was right. That was his Achilles heel.
Do you ever play poker?
I'm not a poker player. The new book about poker I read a review of made me think of, well, do I want to read that? No, if I read that, I might think about playing poker. I did study two of the winners of the International Poker Tournament in Las Vegas. They sought me out because they were hoping I could teach them new tricks. And what they both independently said to me was, the reason why they win at poker is because they can spot bluffs better than other people can. But in poker, the repertoire is very limited. There's no word spoken, and there's just moving chips and picking up cards. And they've developed extraordinary knowledge about what you can read from people and how that's done. But in terms of looking at general aspects of demeanor that I look at during conversation, they were no better than anyone else, but that's not what they're specialized in.
Would you consider it unethical to help poker players read other people's faces so that they could win?
I never thought about that. I don't know whether that's unethical or not. I would imagine. But you wouldn't need, you know, here's another thing I found out. These guys are so low output. They don't make facial expressions. people who are professional poker players are totally unexpressive. So there wasn't anything I could teach them that would be of help to them because of the people they play with and because of the kinds of clues that they're looking for, which is not things that anyone else ordinarily ever does.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a lot of fun.
Paul Ekman talking with Terry Gross. His new book is called Emotions Revealed: Recognizing Faces and Feelings to Improve Communication and Emotional Life. It's published by Times Books.
I've grown accustomed to his face.
She almost makes the day begin.
I've grown accustomed to the tune.
Oh, she whistles night and noon.
His smiles, his frowns,
her ups, her downs are second nature to me now.
Like breathing out and breathing in, I was serenely independent and content before we met.
Surely I could always be that way again, and yet
I've grown accustomed to his looks.
I've grown accustomed to her voice.
Ooh, accustomed to his face.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
I've grown accustomed to his face. It almost makes the day begin. His joys, his woes, his highs, his lows are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Times of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or timesofmaine.com. And by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, fictional stories by Carl Jan Yema. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the musical Gypsy. Bernadette Peters stars in the new Broadway production. We'll speak with her, as well as with Angela Lansbury, who played the lead in London. Also, Stephen Sondheim, who wrote Gypsy's lyrics, and Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book. Join us for the next Fresh Air.